I had to buy a study guide that I could only buy online with a website that literally did not have SSL.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial?
Adversarial.
It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. How's it going, Mario and Sunil?
Going well.
All right. Another lively week in cybersecurity and a number of topics that we're going to jump right into. Hopefully this will be a fun one. Let's kick off with something that's pretty lighthearted, I'd like to say. I came across this one, and you know, just for the audience, the way we pick topics a lot is just what we see, whether it's on social media or news or Slack channels or topics that we see talked about from other security leaders. And we throw them out there, and then if we all agree it's we have something to say about it, we bring it up. What we want to talk about a little bit was certifications, right? I teach at Georgia Tech. I get a lot of students who either are just entering the workforce or looking to make a transition. So I get a lot of questions about what should I do next. And the answer is always get bug bounties and start proving yourself. But I digress. The question always comes up about certifications. Sometimes it's, are certifications worth a damn, professor? Other times it's, which certification should I get first, with the assumption that they're worth something? So I have to think about that a lot. But what triggered this for this week is that a colleague of mine had a LinkedIn post where he's basically saying that ISC2, who administers the CISSP exam originally, and now it seems they've added quite a few on there, that they find it's just a profit center is the word that he used, and that it doesn't have good quality anymore and that sort of thing. And I responded to that with my experience about it. But, you know, let's talk a little bit about that. Is that right? And is it unique to ISC2? Or did you guys get a CISSP at any point?
I think, first of all, mine's lapsed. I think that's the case for most of us at this point. But I got mine back in early 2000s or late 1999, late 1990s, I forget when. But that said, I think at the time, it was a legitimately hard test where if you got it, it demonstrated your bona fides in terms of your ability to do the practice. Over time, and maybe this is the case for many certifications over time, they become less and less worth the paper that they're written on. Whether because of changing technologies or changing standards or just the dilution of the certification itself relative to the skill sets of the people who started the practice.
Hey, Sunil, let me ask you a question on that note. When's the last time you either hire or not hire somebody because they didn't have a CISSP?
Okay, so when I was working at Booz Allen Hamilton, we had federal contracts that required some degree of certification or some degree of experience. And so that became one of the criteria that would dictate whether I can hire somebody or not, or rather not whether I can hire that person, but rather I can put them on a contract. And so unfortunately, we do have those situations where you have to demonstrate some degree of competency from some outside entity. And I think that's going to persist for some time, thereby creating a market for this type of business.
You always have a thoughtful answer to things, Neil.
So, Mario, are you an ex-CISSP too?
I am. And last time I checked, I'm one of the, I think I had it before any of you folks had it, right? Is that correct? Is that what we said?
Yeah, I guess if you compare numbers. I'm not sure. Is a CISSP number like our social security numbers? You know, everyone knows it.
I'm putting it on my LinkedIn right away.
Yeah. Anyway, I got mine back in 99. Back then, I worked for EY, one of the big four. And you're right. I think when folks who were going to perform some sort of activity for them on their behalf, they would want to see our resumes and they would want to see our backgrounds. And also a lot of those clients oftentimes requested certifications. And so this was the one thing you had to take. There were many things you had to do at Ernst & Young, but this was a certification that was required back then. Yeah. So I'll agree with you.
So I think there's also a broader conversation, though, around what are the barriers to entry we want to create for jobs in this space? And I would argue that there are two, you can argue that there are two different tracks of consideration. If you look at a lot of different jobs and disciplines, there are two different tracks. There's like a vocational track and there's a professional track. And as much as we who've been in this industry for a long time would say, hey, we're professionals, I would argue that most of what we have done and can train people to do is more vocational in nature. So if that's the case, then certifications are maybe perfectly fine. But if we want, if we are shooting for a higher bar on something, meaning that the process for validating that you do indeed have these skills need to be at that higher level as well, for which, by the way, many of us may not qualify despite, you know, maybe even the years of practice that we've had. The question really for us as a community, as practitioners is, do we want and need this higher level, higher standard for a professional? And when we hold ourselves to that standard, does it come with other benefits? For example, let's say insurance, like if the SEC comes after us or, you know, there's some sort of professional liability concern, then you know, that sets a new standard for us to consider.
I'll tell you, I'll kind of be contrarian to your contrarian point of view, where when I took it, I had to buy a study guide that I could only buy online with a website that literally did not have SSL. And it was a credit card, put in a credit card and a thing.
Wow.
Right? Mm-hmm. And it was, so right there out of the gate, I was soured on it. And it was a gray market textbook that shipped, a drop ship from India, which I to this day, I don't see a lot of shipping of books from India. That's not a common thing. But this one was. And it was written by a guy who was a maybe a chemi, double E, I think he was a medical doctor, JD. He was just a certification guy. That's all he did. And he cranked out this book, and that was my beginning experience with it. And then when I read through the questions, and there was an exam book, a prep guide, mm-hmm. and so what I'm being contrarian about is you said that it, you know, at first it would measure your bona fides. You said it originally didn't, and it degrades over time. I thought it was crap out of the gate. Like I remember it asking about the orange book versus the red book, and what the hell is that? What does that have to do with security? Right, I thought it was awful then. I assume it got better. That now it's actually maybe okay. I don't know, but did you find that the questions were helpful to being a security expert back then? Or do you remember?
I barely remember. I do remember the orange book, or at least the different color books. And coming, I had a foundation of from starting from DoD anyway, so that kind of stuff was like, oh, of course. But for obvious reasons, it doesn't necessarily apply to those in the non-DoD space. But that's it. I think the initial 10 bodies of knowledge, if I recall, it was 10 bodies of knowledge that we had to make sure we had good coverage over. I thought that was a pretty decent coverage at the time. There's always improvements. And of course, I think now it's not 10 bodies of knowledge anyway. They've made revisions. But this perspective of, as a starting point, we have a pretty robust set of topics and disciplines that we expect for people to pass. And if I recall, it wasn't you had to pass all 10. You had to pass like 7 out of 10 or something like that. You had to demonstrate competency in a decent number of these bodies of knowledge. It wasn't that you had to know what the orange book was, but rather that you could at least cover, you know, these other sort of disciplines. And I think that's a reasonable ask. But I also remember this one time I was conversing with a CISSP. In fact, they blazoned it on their signature line. And they were asking me, oh, what is PKI? That was the person that was asking. And they said, you know, here, I'm a CISSP. I'm
like, when was that, Sunil?
That was early 2000s. I mean, it was late enough that they should have known. Well, I thought they should have known what PKI was. But that was my first indication of what has this test come down to? Like, if they don't even understand that, what are they really learning? I'm contradicting myself saying, do I expect somebody to know all these disciplines? No. Do I expect them to know some like things that are pretty well known? Yeah. But maybe again, I'm holding people to a higher standard than maybe what this vocational certification is intended for.
Well, it's interesting you say that when Jerry, you mentioned the Orange Book. Sunil, you mentioned the Orange Book. And I kid you not, that was the one thing that stuck with me out of all those questions was the freaking blue, orange, whatever the name of that book was.
What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. Rainbow. Mm-hmm. So I'll admit, I used to be a volunteer for ISC2, mm-hmm. and I got to write some of the test questions that people would have. And so, So here's a little background on that. When you take this test, there were some questions that just make no freaking sense. Either mm-hmm. they're really super uber technical in an area or space in technology that you are not as familiar mm-hmm. with, or it was just made no freaking audit sense. Why are we talking about this kind of thing? And so the logic behind that was that they would, the ISC2, this is, goes back to 2000, so I don't know if they've changed, but they would have 20% of those questions, 15 to 20%, as candidate questions that you were not rated on. They were just going to see what, you know, whether people understood it. And if it was well understood, they would include them in into the ones that you actually were going to be rated on. And then some of the older ones that you were rated on, if they weren't as good anymore, they'd get rid of them because their technology was old, right? No tape backups anymore, et cetera.
I'm not against the idea of tests in general, though. So people who've worked with me, you know, I'm notorious for a hiring quiz. Like six people listening to podcasts just busted out laughing because they worked with me in the past. Notorious for it. So I would always have a 5-question quiz that I would give to anybody who made it past some screening. You know, they make it through HR. And by the way, the CISSP keyword, I do tell people sometimes you need keywords to get through algorithmic screening, through recruiter screening. You know, they don't know any better. So sure.
True.
But once you're through there, you know, when I got the, hey, Jerry, there's this candidate that looks really good. Will you talk to them? That's not sustainable, right? In a large organization, I can't talk to everyone, but then you feel like a jerk too, hopefully. So I'd say, well, just give them the quiz. And, you know, my organization was great. And they got to the point where they're like, okay, we already gave them the quiz. Here's the answer. And I could read through a free response, 5 questions. I actually wrote out the response. Sounds like it sucks because you can't grade it with an algorithm. But it would take me maybe 90 seconds to read through it. And I would just be like, yeah, that's a B+. That's an A. It's a subjective grading. But it worked really well. And then I remember at Silicon Valley Bank, we had to hire some people. And I did the same thing. I say, hey, do you want to talk to all the candidates? Because what most companies do is they have a panel of 7 managers interview every candidate. But you know how that works. Only 3 are available, this candidate. 4 are available, different ones on the next candidates. You can't compare apples to apples. It's just awful. So I said, no, we're not going to have this big panel and sideline all of my senior management to interview every candidate here. Send them the quiz. People got all nervous. I hear back a week or two later, we can't send a quiz. Legal says it's not okay. Okay, that's weird. So then I happen to be in New York, and I run across the general counsel of Silicon Valley Bank. I said, hey, you're not going to believe this, but here's what I do. I kind of talked up the idea of quizzes and got them all excited about it. And I said, so anyway, I tried to do that, and I was told legal couldn't do it. He goes, what are you talking about? Nah, let's cut some red tape, buddy. Let's go. Nah. Forward me that email. I'll make sure it's good. I forward it. He writes back. I'm sure it's great, but let me just, you know, check a few things. Comes back to me maybe 2 weeks later. No, we can't send that. Sorry, I can't talk about it anymore. The bureaucracy. But anyway, I wanted to bring it up because I looked up a CISSP sample question while we're chatting here, and this is what they're giving you. They have a sample quiz online. Which of the following security instruction options offers the most potential for real-time feedback? And some of the answers are live training, remote rote memorization, reward Who gives a damn? What does this have to do with keeping you from getting owned?
This could be one of those candidate questions as well, though. They may still do that, right?
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to have shitty candidate questions just to see if shitty questions are good, right? You'd want to have viable questions at least to see if they're... So here's like an example that I use, though. I have one that says, what's an example of an idea or project you came with on your own that turned into a coding project? What tech did you use? How'd you get it hosted? Mm. What did you have to learn to make it work? Any URLs or repo links to share? That's gold dust, right? Mm. Give people some room to run. I think it's possible to have a good exam is what I'm saying, but man, we're not doing it right now.
Let me poll with you two here. My team, there was a very technical group, and also the audit team that also reported to me, but they also were pretty technical. But the ones that were writing code, okay, custom code. They would give a test, security test, usually in Python.
Ooh.
How many of you folks have ever attempted to take that test that your team, did your team do that, built their own native testing? And two, did you ever take it? And three, did you pass? Because I'll tell you right now, I wouldn't have been hired by my team if I had to take that test. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to come out clean.
Yeah, I've never had to take a coding test outside college. And judging how I did on them in college, I wouldn't have done too well with your team either.
Yes, my team did have a test. Two, I did take it. Three, I barely passed. But then again, we're talking about a skill set for which we are no longer that shouldn't be our core competency anyway. So the fact that I barely passed, in fact, I should have probably failed, meaning that I'm spending too much time on things that I shouldn't be spending time on anymore.
You know, one of the things that comes up on the heels of this is there such thing as a cybersecurity degree? And my, you know, I've gone back and forth. I do feel like in practice, we're building on something, right? I used to say there's three pillars: networks, systems, and coding, and that you kind of have to have one of those first.
I mentioned earlier the type of tests that we're talking about, and I can give you a very technical test, asking questions like at a protocol level. Or if I'm actually trying to professionalize this practice and I want to see whether or not you have the right type of not just technical skills, but business skills and leadership skills to run a security organization. Now, so I'm now talking at the, you know, at a CSO level, it's a whole different set of things I'd be asking for. In fact, again, if I'm asking, if you happen to fail because you don't know, you know, this very small nuanced topic around how a layer 6 protocol works, okay? I mean, I don't know. That's not something that I'd expect at some level of professionalization, those become irrelevant.
Mm. I want to double click on that. So my incident response team would approach me on an annual basis that they wanted to follow a SANS course in incident response. And, you know, if you get a group, I don't quote me on this, but it was anywhere between 7 to 10,000 per person.
Yeah.
Okay. Crazy. For SANS. Okay. And all these cats would like, my incident response people were like, yeah, this, you need this. It's the thing that makes you stand out. I'm like, for the love of God, you're on incidents every freaking day. All right. What the heck are you like? You guys should be writing a book about what you do. Why am I having to get a certification and paying SANS? I'm not putting down SANS. I'm just at that level.
That's next episode.
Yes, at that level, what's Neil saying? You're just kind of that technical, that I would expect you to be a expert in this area. Have you guys encountered that?
You know, to me, I mandated training. This is pretty interesting. So we were talking a moment ago about people, especially with government work, that wants you to prove that you have some level of skill. And how do you do it? How do you quantify it? You sometimes throw some certs at it. So we had that to some degree. In the other way, we had one of our key controls, right? You get to assert your own key controls. And one of them was that we had good people. And so we said, well, how are we going to do key control testing on that? And so we had the GRC team actually go through and track for every single employee. They were allowed to have a week of dedicated offsite training and then have an on-the-job component of it. And so to that regard, if they came back and said, oh, well, I picked to satisfy your criteria the SANS, yeah, sometimes we'd say, well, can't you just go to Black Hat or something and maybe, you know, it'd be a little bit cheaper, or go to the FSISAC Summit. That was always awesome as far as value goes. But, you know, we did end up putting them through some of that. And, you know, in other words, it was more than just that they were going to figure out something they don't know. There was also a degree of, it was a perk. And they get to unplug for a minute, decompress, meet some peers.
I understand SANS is expensive. It's probably more expensive than even you just quoted. But that said, I think there's a perspective I would also offer, which is I don't know if this is always the case, but I would say the people whose companies send them to SANS training are your high performers, should be your high performers. That's to Jerry's point. Those are the people being rewarded. And you oftentimes get to meet other people in other industries, other companies because of those environments. And you're rubbing shoulders with other high performance, mm-hmm. high performing people as well. So I think there is something to be said about that experience, which because of the high threshold that they've already set, it kind of limits the population to begin with in terms of who comes and who you interact with. I think FSISAC is a great example of a cheaper alternative. But if you don't have access to something like FSISAC, I'm not sure what other venues you have where you can bring in high quality people on a regular basis.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. So look, next thing that we have coming up here. So I saw this article, and it was particularly talking about, is the vulnerability disclosure process glitched? And it was kind of confusing because it was trying to talk about VDPs, so vulnerability disclosure programs, and whether companies ignore them too much. And vulnerability disclosure programs are kind of a cousin of bug bounty programs. They're often hosted on the same sites as that, and they're espoused by CISA, and the idea that you should be welcoming to hearing about problems in your product. And so let's kind of talk about them and bug bounties at the same time. I definitely have seen firsthand, I've witnessed where if people find a problem and they submit it either via VDP or by an actual bug bounty program, that yes, they want their reward, they want their $2,000, their $5,000, but they also really want you to acknowledge it, and they want to see it move the needle. They want to see that you made a change. And they get very frustrated if you don't fix whatever it is. And this article in particular talks about how if you don't acknowledge them and you don't actually fix it, that you might not get as many people participating in the program, you might not get the value. I think what they were dancing around, though, that bug bounty advocates don't like to talk about, is that these are also potentially gray hat folks that are kind of upset with you. And that's not a smart strategic move to upset people and ignore them when you know that they're in the business of finding security holes and have one in their back pocket for your product. That said, when I looked through the article, it made me realize that there's a big difference in the organizations that are creating privileged software that are executed by the world's companies. So the SolarWinds and Ivanti, also people who are writing libraries, whether it's closed source or open source, that are being relied on, right? Because if they have bugs, they're putting other people at risk. And I think we act like, and this article certainly does, like that's the majority of organizations. And in reality, I think that's the minority. And that for most companies, having to, you know, if they hear about a bug, it's only affecting them. And so they don't have this almost moral obligation to immediately publish a CVE and let the whole world know. And that's kind of what this article was expressing a little bit of outrage about, is that they disclose something to a company and then they're not seeing a CVE and they're not seeing some big publication about it. What I'm tying into that is Secure by Design. Right? That's a big CISA initiative to try to get better secure code out. And I'll just bundle the whole shift left movement in this too. I feel like all this emphasis on code security, secure by design, is super relevant if you're creating software being used by the world's organizations. But I feel like that's less than 5%, maybe 1% of companies, and that the majority of companies don't need to be hyper-focused. That should not be their first priority, and code defects is not the thing that's leading to ransomware around the world. Am I wrong?
I would agree with your general position, but I think you're really minimizing the extent of what a company, what you're saying 5%. I think my argument with you is not 5%. I think it's higher than 5%. I think we're talking 15, 20, maybe a quarter of those companies do get involved. I'll tell you a story. There is this company that built drivers. Drivers, just connectors and drivers for software. So this is not exciting work. Most often companies will outsource it to a company that specializes in this particular area. It's not just drivers or connectors, something else. But it's not the core function of that company. But it turns out that company had a lot of big customers, including some of the big name software companies in the world. And this was, they were giving their business to a small company that may not have had the right SDLC in place, the right security hygiene. And so your argument may be that, okay, well, they're not, you know, they're not this big player, but the software they built is used by big players that in turn is used by their clients.
Yeah, so let me push back on the ratios as well. I would just say the Pareto ratio of 80-20 would tend to apply pretty frequently. So there's 20% of companies that create the software, 80% of the software that we use. Okay, so but there's a bunch of other ones, 80% of the remaining 80% of companies that produce the 20% of software that we use. That's a long tail of software companies. And if there are practices that we can promote that help them build just slightly more secure software, that may go a long way. I think so there's a lot more to unpack in your opening statement. First, I would also add that those who complain about us not responding to vulnerability disclosure emails and whatnot have never seen a bag bounty before. And there's a ton of those.
Yeah.
We should also expect to see more LLM-generated bug bounty submissions, which are just pure crap, right? So there's a lot of noise that's being introduced into the ecosystem that makes it hard for us to triage and to know exactly which ones are legit and which ones are not. It's not trivial to fully investigate a particular bug bounty to determine which ones are legit and truly exploitable. Services like HackerOne and Synac and BugCrowd can help with that. I think those are great services, and I would strongly recommend anybody who wants to try to have a robust vulnerability disclosure program and a bug bounty leverage those resources, because doing it on your own is a real pain in the butt, and there's a lot of triage work.
Yeah, and I think if there's a benefit to these bug bounty programs is, you know, even though they're being paid by the customer, they really do try to be a fair, in my opinion, judge of whether something's applicable or not, as opposed to going directly to the client, the impacted client. I think they really do a good job. I really think so.
Yeah, the triage that you pay for. Yeah,
that's right.
I think it's pretty good.
That's honestly, I think that's primarily what we're paying for, the triage part.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll tell you, like, so to get back to my point of, like, should the world be worried about secure by design? I just brought up like the Fortune 2000 and went to the end of it, which is like starting to get into the world that we and that CISA is worried about securing, right? I mean, we're not all trying to secure three banks. They got this. The whole idea here is to get the larger ecosystem. And when I go through that, I'm like around 1800. So I'm just looking through some of these companies here. Steel Authority of India, like is software defects what's going to put them down? First Quantum Minerals. It's pretty hard for me to believe that. Ramsey Healthcare in Australia.
Okay, well, so hold on. Let's consider then. Andreessen, you know, had the software's eating the world about 12, 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. And more recently said, you know, now every company is essentially a software company. To what degree is that actually true? And if that is true now for minimally a majority, maybe. If it's a majority of companies that are where majority of companies are now software companies, then I think the notion of focusing on software security as a fundamental tenet of software security being our key vulnerability or source of vulnerabilities, then that would arguably be something that we should focus on.
Well, no, I disagree. So I think you're right. A lot of these are technology companies, right? So like, let's say Kohl's. This is number 1,874 on the Fortune 2000, Kohl's. I'm not saying, hey, it's Kohl's. They're not software. I bet they are. I bet they are a technology company a lot. I bet when you go in there, their supply chain management system, they probably have a lot of homebrew, probably doing amazing stuff. But if they have a bunch of internal SaaS-detected defects, as a shareholder, I don't care. That's not where they need to be. Like, and if CISA is giving them the message and their execs are coming into the boardroom and saying, like, CISO, what are we doing about secure by design? I want to make sure we're only issuing secure software. I'm thinking, whoa, what a misappropriation of resource, because that's not true. Bug bounty, you know what you're going to find? They're going to have configuration errors. They're going to have misconfigured cloud stuff. It's not code that's taking them down. Now, if you move, forgive my long rant here, but if you move down this list a little bit, not too far off of them is a company that you may have heard of called Cloudflare. Now here, totally different story. Yeah, Cloudflare, secure by design. And I bet they have directors walking in the boardroom right now saying, we got to get this right. People are relying on us. I agree. But it took me like 30 or 40 companies to find them. The majority of them, even if they produce a lot of software, they're not shipping binaries that are being used in trusted applications by heavily targeted organizations.
Go for it. We're picking on you today, Jerry. You brought this up on your own. You brought this on your own, man. So I think you're approaching this whole CISA argument from, you know, my hat as the former CISO of the ICE, right? The New York Stock Exchange. You're thinking like that, right? Mm-hmm. But what about, isn't CISA supposed to be there for a public good as well? It's not just for companies, but also for the public. Okay, well, if we agree with that, I bet you there's a lot of software companies that are developing for software for children. Hmm. And even though they may not be a big company, and they may not be a top 1,000, top 2,000.
Roblox is right on this list, by the way.
I don't want to listen. Should have an episode on Roblox security one day, okay? Anyway, but back to this. I would think as a parent, I would want to ensure that the software that my children are using at school has some level of, you know, secure by design, hopefully. Because they're our children.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not worried about SQL injection affecting my kids. I mean, I'm more worried about all the bastards that are on that platform talking through great, perfectly architected software. I'm more worried about the social side than the code defects. I mean, and just think about how expensive all these stupid school tools are going to be if people are actually doing perfect security early on.
So what would be CISA has a mission to help secure critical infrastructure.
Yep.
If not a secure by design mandate, what would be an appropriate equivalent mandate for those who are not manufacturers of security as a predominant function?
Oh, man, I think I could come up with a good answer on that, and just baking it a little, I would say it's something about risk management, about knowing your priorities, about knowing what your exposure is going to be, identifying that, and testing. Testing the stuff that people are counting on you to get right.
What if the alternative then is to say, look, even if you're not a manufacturer of software, here are some principles that you should then ask your vendors who do produce software to adhere to.
Perhaps. I you know, the last thing I need is Rico, right? The copier company, for example. I'm just looking at this list, hammering more vendors with more questions about their software, because then we have the TPRM arms race that brews back up.
I think so. I'm not at all in favor of TPRM practices that just make it, that becomes just a security theater. But I think there are some practices that become much easier to demonstrate, especially in software, because it's so tangible in terms of artifacts, right? So, for example, let's talk about SBOM. SBOM is something that is mentioned frequently. I frankly don't care what's in your SBOM. I just want to know if you can produce one.
Okay. I like that.
Agreed.
If you can't produce one, that means that either your software stack is so outdated that you can't produce one, or you have a really poor software development lifecycle that can't produce one. But if you can produce one, then either it's a modern tech stack or you have a good software development process. Mm-hmm. That's all I want to know.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you, because SBOMs are, in practice, just to put a fine point on it, right? So here's a list. You give I'm going to pick on you here, the Bank of America TPRM team that's from some local boutique firm who got subcontracted through four other firms, and they're hitting up somebody and they have no idea what they even provide, and they're asking them for a SBOM. So you give it to them, and then what? They're going to look through this list of 1,200 libraries and say, here, it says here that you're using X version, and there was a big CVE out for it, so we need to know that you patched it. Oh, my God, right? I mean, we gave you the SBOM 6 months ago. We've patched it every day since then. It's irrelevant. Why are you wasting my time? So that would be my normal response to SBOM. But I agree with you, and it goes back to, I think it was a few weeks ago, I had said, like, if there's one thing you could do to see if somebody's secure, it would be try to make an update on your webpage. Just show me you can get an update on your main website within 12 hours. And that's very similar to the org that can produce an SBOM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I bet. Because it's agility.
Exactly. Because if there's a flaw, I want to know that you can go and fix that flaw. And being able to produce an SBOM is an indicator that you can fix a flaw.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I like measures like that that says, yeah, you can figure things out. Mm-hmm. So I didn't jump on it, but when you mentioned your kid's software and wanting to know that it's memory safe. No, I'm just kidding. I'm putting words in your mouth. But when you mentioned that, it immediately made me think of another topic that I wanted to discuss today. So my daughter was sitting here with her Chromebook next to me, and then she happened to ask about what APIs were, and I used my large screen and I showed her, and I used Google DevTools to go to some website and then show her the source code. I was like, cool, this is a good introduction to HTML and CSS. And then ultimately I was going to demonstrate like the difference in static content versus how you populate all the data in there in an API. And so she had her Chromebook sitting there with Chrome, as you might imagine. And she said, oh, wait, how do I do that? And the light went off to me. I thought, we're making a connection here. She's about to, you know, have an amazing future. I said, oh, you hit F11 or F12. Even now, I don't remember which one it was. Always hit both. Or you could right click, and everything was grayed out. Because the school runs the Chromebook policy, which I like most of the time. I love the fact that there's a lot of restrictions on there. I'm hugely in favor of it. She has a 6-digit numerical password, single factor auth on a publicly accessible account, just like tens of thousands of students next to her, and it's fine. They're not getting owned because they have very low, you know, attack surface. So I generally like restrictions, but she can't view source code. She can't view source, not allowed. And I thought that was completely misguided, and I have all kinds of metaphors about how CISOs do similar things. What's your initial blush on that?
Okay, so there's a whole argument about tethered systems. Like, let's say an iPhone is generally, it may change in the near future, but an iPhone is a tethered system, and Android is not. Okay, which ecosystem tends to be more secure?
iOS.
A tethered system tends to be more secure. And because of that, and another way to put it also, like Windows versus Mac, Windows is a much more general purpose. Mac is a much more closed, tethered system. When you can exert controls, when you can have a centralized mechanism that exerts controls over that ecosystem, it tends to be more secure, okay? And as long as that tethered or that type of system continues to satisfy the needs of the vast majority of people who use it, those vast majority of people who use it will be happy with the outcome. But then you have those people who are not, who want to tinker and tweak and so on and so forth. And I would say for those people, maybe a school-issued Chromebook isn't the right choice for them. You want to give them, here's a Linux machine or something that lets them operate the system in a more general purpose way. But I think the perspective I would offer is we buy ourselves a lot of safety margin by operating tethered systems rather than a general purpose system.
Mm. This reminds me of a conversation I've had throughout my life, throughout my career in security is, I've had the executives requesting that we take admin rights to people's machines, right? And my whole argument has been to Sunil's point, there is sometimes when you could say, fine, I'll do that maybe for the marketing team. Maybe I'll do it for certain members of the financial team because a lot of those financial team members also need to do a lot of, I hate to say macros because I'm going to date myself, but they have to be power users in Excel, all right? So it sometimes can get a little complicated if they're not administrators. So I don't like putting these controls on people, quite honestly, but I do think there are some easy wins that can make your executives happy. You can say, fine, I'll do it on sales. Why not? Marketing, why not? But the minute we start getting into engineer or IT people, especially if they're running, I don't want to get into this unholy war between Linux and Macs or Windows, but if they're not Windows, they're running Linux or Macs, then go for it. Do it. Hmm. I'll give you admin rights.
Well, I think it's really cool when you said, and Sunil, I don't know if you picked up on this, but you said you had execs wanting you to pull LAR, local admin rights, which immediately tells me that you were on the, like, hold on a minute. That, why do you want to do that? And I bet Sunil, like me, we grew up on, and most CISOs you see are kind of the other way around, where they want to pull local admin rights, and the business leadership, they actually just don't care. But once they start hearing the belly aching about it from engineering, et cetera, they're advocating for, why do we have to do this? I was told it's going to delay a major release. I'm counting on what's the problem here? I love it. I think that's good CISOing. If you're advocating for tinkerers, advocating for technologists first, and being draconian second.
Yeah, the way I've characterized this in the context of the cyber defense matrix, for those who know, is, yeah, there's different allergies that different parts of the business have. Local admin, so developers have an allergy to removing admin from their machines, right? You remove admin from their machines and they break out in allergies and say, I can't do my work. Putting in a firewall into a high-speed trading environment, bad idea, right? They have severe allergies to a firewall or anything that adds latency in a high-speed trading environment. And of course, for whatever reason, these execs, senior execs, tend to have lots of allergies for, you know, just about everything. But the point is that each group has a distinct set of allergies. And what experienced security people should have at this point is a general sense of, okay, these people, like, for example, marketing people, try to approve every application they use ahead of time before they use it.
Yep.
Good luck, right?
Yep.
It's we know that's an allergy. We recognize it. We build controls around that allergy, and recognize that, you know, there's we do risk management to allow exceptions in those cases because they have those allergies.
Marketing people love their software, their new software, their new SaaS application, you're right. Try to do some sort of third party assessment on those. It's a pirate victory if you're successful. At the same time, a lot of those marketing tools vendors may not be practicing CISA secure by design, folks. Okay, all right.
Yeah,
and it's
fully agree. Yeah. And this is where we take the perspective of, you know, how do we ensure that we either limit the blast radius or we recognize that that's going to be the case. They're going to be experimenting with crazy software that was just built somewhere in Russia. Okay. All right. Okay. Let's make sure that
all software was built somewhere in Russia
or by Russians. Yeah, a lot of software was built by Russians.
Developer in a wagon down by the river developing remotely.
Yeah. A lot of that. A lot of that going on.
But the perspective at the end of the day is that we want to create the right kind of constraints. And whether those constraints are these tethered systems versus general purpose systems, you know, that as a constraint helps us manage our security controls and not have to fight a losing battle or trying to secure a system, a general purpose system that doesn't need to be general purpose for, let's say, a marketing person.
Mm. Yeah, I hate to miss the forest for the trees here, because I think you had a really good reply to it, Sunil. And put another way, maybe a more brutal way, it's less support calls to the help desk if you limit the number of options that they have and that sort of thing. And I get that. I think that there is a technical difference that a lot of people are missing, though. So local admin rights was a great point on that. And I'm an advocate of that, like especially as you up your threat profile and you're more worried about things, including your SolarWinds, that kind of thing. You got to start pulling local admin rights, not everywhere, but more and more, or maybe even everywhere if you have tools that enable it for just the things that you need to do. And the reason is when malware detonates on boxes, there are some things that it can only do with admin rights. And so if it can operate with admin rights, it's more dangerous. That's the sound argument. Let's be more specific. Like dumping LSAS on Windows boxes and looking at hashed credentials. You can't do that without admin. So you won that battle if you pull back admin with you. But when CISOs tell me that they didn't allow their users to have a command prompt, to open a command prompt, I think they don't get technology. They're not really good at this job,
yeah,
at security. Because I don't see how, what a, you guys get it. When you have RCE, you don't need the command prompt to be able to run the commands.
Yeah,
I think they're just unqualified. And to me, that's developer mode in Chrome, because you can't do anything. Chrome is awesome at blowing itself away all the time every time you run it, right? You can't break Chrome in developer mode. I think people just don't get it.
Okay, so let me offer secure by default, safe by default. Okay, so secure by design includes safe, secure by default as a consideration. Okay, I don't think secure by default is actually the right term. I think it's more safe by default. But let me offer the fact that it's even a configuration implies something. The fact that you can configure it to be on or off implies that someone thought, someone, a designer said, maybe somebody might want this off. Hmm. For example, you know, a kiosk mode type of system, I would think you would want that off, right?
Hmm.
Okay, and why? Because there's some threat model associated with when operating in a kiosk mode, someone who can pull up developer mode and see the transactions might be able to do something.
Yeah, I also think it's the age of the company, and maybe not even necessarily, the vertical could explain it, but also the age of the company. When you're that young, when you're working with startups, you're not going to put these constraints on companies and people. They need to move fast. They need to move quickly. They need to be nimble.
Yeah.
But as they age, mature, they become public companies, you might have to start having additional requirements that you have to deal with. On a personal basis, I don't envy you guys. I would find it boring if everybody had no admin access, like either banking or in the exchange.
You're a cyber union guy. You want to preserve some job security.
Working in the valley makes you, kind of edgy. I like that edginess.
Well, so to that narrative about a startup, with a startup, everyone wears a lot of hats. And because you wear a lot of hats, specializing on a particular profile for your security posture may not be feasible because you just wear all these hats. As the company gets larger and you start distributing those hats to other people, you now have a person that only does this one hat. Well, then you could actually design security controls that's optimized for that type of person, right? But it certainly doesn't make sense when you have in a startup or a smaller organization, you have people who have so many different hats that there is no singular profile for them.
Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, I have a startup, right? We had to wrestle with the same thing. And yeah, we wouldn't say it was just TPRM, but like we're in the business of asking people to put very sensitive data on our platform. So we are in the Fortune 2 billion, we are the number on there. We say, they do have to get it right. And I thought, well, are we going to drop no local admin rights and this, that, and the other on everybody right out of the gate? Hey, I come from a big Fortune company. Look at me. I can thump my chest and show how I can strip out local admin rights. To Mario's point, that was a bad way to come out of the gate. Mm-hmm. But I did think that we had to have a good response to questionnaires. And even Bank of America comes and says, do you restrict local admin rights in row 408 of the spreadsheet? Our end result was to have a risk-based approach. So we said, yeah, we know we have an exposure. Let's threat model it. And who has to have access to Postgres, right? Oh, you know what? Jerry doesn't have to have that access. Okay, well, maybe we can have a different security control model. And it's kind of like, if you're going to have access to the most important data, then you're going to also have to work in the slightly more restrictive environment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. It's a balancing act.
Yeah.
Speaking of admin rights, a very similar note, something came up. And I think this is actually pretty important. I had a friend ping me. He's a CISO, and he's at a startup that's fast moving, and they're dealing with these same political fights, but it is a public company. So they're a little further down the road. They're getting TPRM. They're heavily regulated, a lot of that stuff. So they can't just, kind of fly by the seat of their pants. He came from the old school, though, kind of like me, where we used to have a lot of network segmentation, LANs, all those types of concepts. And, you know, he came from where the auditors were always asking the same questions about segregation of duties and stripping local admin rights. And the particular issue that came up for him was auditors ask, do you use a separate account for administrative actions? And I remember that question. I might have asked that question. I cared about that question. I believed it, unlike most audit questions. And it was, you know, you have a, let's talk about it, Windows Active Directory. You have your username that you surf the web with and that you check your email with. And it was absolutely mandatory that you'd have a, well, we used to call them A-dash accounts, right? So A-dash Sunil instead of just regular Sunil, separate login, separate credentials, separate policies, really annoying big password, because these are back in the days when passwords mattered too, by the way. So it made sense to have a separate account. And it also meant that when you got owned while you're working on your computer, no one could do all this cool domain admin stuff because, crap, it's just regular old plebeian Sunil and all I could do is read his email. I can't log into the domain controller and all that because I don't have A-Sunil. And he's basically saying, look, my young, nimble company laughs at me when I bring this stuff up. And they say, yeah, of course we use the Gmail login to also log into GCP and to log and to admin our cloud resources, our production. And he's just, you know, blowing a fuse over that, saying, this is nuts. How could he possibly do it? And he pinged me to say, am I crazy, Jerry? And at first I said, oh, yeah, of course you have to have separate admin accounts. And then when I heard about the environment, I said, oh, yeah, actually, now that you mention it, it is kind of tough to do that nowadays. And maybe it is antiquated and obsolete. And we started talking about it. What do you guys think? Are you still espousing the separate admin account? And if not, why? What is different?
So let's think about the underlying premise behind the separate admin account. There are two actual controls here. And when we think about defense in depth, the second control is actually not a second technical control. The second control is a procedural control.
Okay. Mm. Mm.
And when we think about defense in depth, we oftentimes just think, oh, let's layer on another technical control. But what makes what makes security stronger is when you have two or three orthogonal controls, a technical control, a procedural control, and a people control. Okay, if you have all three, it'd be really hard for an attacker to really circumvent all three.
And people, process, and technology, right?
Exactly.
That's your thing in
right.
CDM. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think in the context of what is it that we are really trying to do when it comes to elevated accounts or admin accounts, it's not the technical control as much as it was the procedural part of it, the process side of it. Hey, when you do this action, one, know that you're operating in God mode and you can do something really, really dangerous, but you actually have to do something different to make that, to initiate that
activity. And just to be clear, log in with the other account.
You log in with that other account, and it's a very distinct set of actions. Effectively, you know, if I want you to make me a sandwich, and I can say sudo make me a sandwich, that I had to actually change how I ask you to make me a sandwich. Okay, if I don't, then you might not make me a sandwich. But anyway, that's it. The point is that there is a intentional change in how I do things that has to be a factor in what made this a more secure outcome.
A whole other topic could have been, I don't know about you guys, but I'm sure I had at least one moment where I thought, sudo is a farce. We've all been living a lie, right? Because we had auditors say, it's probably a knock on from the exact same audit question about separate accounts. It was, do these users have root level privilege by default? Oh, no, they don't. And then maybe all of us at some point observed how SysEng was working, how SREs was working. And they just typed sudo before it. And they had the right in sudo to actually run any command they want, elevated. And he thought, well, you just run sudo before su, and then you just work as root all day, every day. But I think to Sunil's point, there actually was security value in it. Mm. Because it just wasn't by default, right? And yeah, in that particular scenario, an intruder getting in might have had God mode access because they just run sudo. But it meant that when you typed rm-r*, or when you accidentally did this stuff, and say, hey, you forgot to say, you know, you got to say Simon Says, you forgot to say sudo. And you're like, oh, thank God I forgot to say it, because that was not what I meant to do. So there is value. Yeah, and I hadn't codified it the way you just did. It was value because of procedure.
You know, I can go so many different ways on this topic. This is such an interest. We should even make a whole episode on this topic, quite honestly. There's so many angles on it. But I'm going to poo on the whole concept of these users and different naming conventions for administrators and non-administrator access. I think that stuff is just past us. All right? I think I like to argue now that instead of Muhammad going to the mountain has gone to has come to Muhammad. How so? Well, people are changing now the access that you have. It's no longer the user that you're using, but rather the access that you're granted. What people are starting to realize, SaaS is an example, but I can argue databases as well, or internal on-prem servers as well, etc. But basically, why are we granted this permanent authorization when we're only used 5% of that time to do those workloads or to use whatever we're supposed to be doing with those elevated privilege? And so what companies are doing, really smart companies, and they're doing a business, they're making a business out of this, is to simply say, we're going to learn from you and the group you're in, and we're going to start looking for patterns on how often you really need this access to all this data, all this information. And we think that you only need it 1% of the time. The rest of the time, we're going to just remove your user from having that access. And we programmatically allow you to have access on a given period, or maybe you want to request elevation and say, I need this for right now. Here's the reason. Here's a ticket. Give me the access. Boom, let's go to town. I think that's where the industry's going, rather than having a name, a user that has an administrator on it or a non-user administrator.
Yeah, the whole notion of just-in-time versus standing privileges is what you're talking about. And correct. I think we should generally move towards a just-in-time model as much as possible. I've actually thought about this in terms of, can we redefine least privilege? Not based on what the actual privilege is, but based on the volume under the curve, the time curve, for yes. how much you actually have a certain level of privilege. So let's say you only had root for a second. Yes, you can still do lots of damage with root, but if you only had it for a short period of time, is that equivalent? Could that be equivalent to least privilege, where you just have very few privileges for a long period of time? Okay, I don't fully believe that myself, but I'm trying to rationalize this as a.
Why not? I mean, look, with the length of password and the complexity of passwords. If we go back to the original idea, was how many passwords can get compromised through brute force after a certain period? Right. And so, you know, at 50%, at 90 days, you would think these many will fall if given this kind of password complexity. And so it's all about the ability for the attacker to be able to compromise something. If the exposure of that employee is maybe 5 minutes out of 2 weeks, mm-hmm. man, that attacker better have a really good, you know, better be really lucky, which could happen.
Right.
Or you have poor defenses. I hate to say that, folks. You have poor defenses where an attacker gained a footprint in one of your browser extensions or your machine, and you weren't able to detect it. Sorry, I'm gonna poo on that. If you have somebody there for more than 2-3 weeks and you haven't noticed it, you got other problems.
To like kind of recast what Sunil said, right? Get a conclusion from my buddy here who was wondering about it, and what he was basically saying is like, I'm open minded. Maybe the A-dash accounts is dated, but I want to rationalize that in my own mind and know that I'm not just, you know, making a off-the-cuff decision here. I want something defensible and sustainable. I love that. And I think we're getting there. And what I think it is to your point, Sunil, the A-dash account wasn't good because it's a different account. That's kind of the means. The ends, though, was that it was defense in depth through another axis. It was either people, process, or technology. And I might contend that in today's environment, you log in with Gmail, G Suite, so long as when you try to access resources in GCP, you get stepped up, right? And maybe it pings your manager, and maybe it's break glass, that it is 100% as good. And if you're an auditor or a regulatory examiner or TPRM, and you're coming in and you ask that first question about multiple accounts, and you get told, no, we use the same account, but when we try to get to these types of resources, we have step up auth and we ping other people, that you need to say, A+, way to go, and not get hung up on the means to the ends.
Right. because it's the process control that's really what we're trying
to do. The question should be, do you have this or a similar diversity of process?
Well, I have another question for you guys. So you have two accounts. You guys that had two different accounts, your regular user and your administrator users. How many of you guys use the administrator by default? Because, I got to do my administrator job. I don't need to really do my regular user.
I didn't because it wasn't any good at surfing the web, and that's what I wanted to do all day.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, because you're locking it down. I mean, you don't, like, it shouldn't have email at all, right? It shouldn't have web access. There's no reason for it to have those things. Yeah, and in the modern world with, like, Google Workspace, I do actually have two accounts, my regular user and my admin user. But the threat model that I'm trying to deal with is browser-based. I don't want sessions, just in case there's a, you know, some info stealer, I have a whole separate browser with no extensions, and I've skinned the browser so that it's very clear that this is a admin browser, and that's where I do all my Google admin work. So, again, and let me make sure it's clear, the threat model I'm concerned about is info stealers, and specifically browser-based, like, plugins and extensions that we know can be riddled with various flaws. So that's what I'm trying to address.
I mean, how effective is it when you have a bunch of, like, in the cloud or SaaS products, and now you have modern IDPs, right? So you have, for example, if I'm going to go to, let's say, AWS, and it's my production environment, am I going to give everybody in the company access to the production environment? Not likely, right? Not likely. Not to the computing instance, not to the VPC, et cetera, et cetera. So what has happened, actually, is you have an IDP that's assigned for your business applications, your Salesforce of the world, right? Your Workdays of the world. And that everybody uses. And they may have a different password requirement, may have maybe longer rotations, longer, et cetera. But the minute you have that employee accessing your AWS production environment, they have to log into a different IDP. It might be the same vendor, but they don't trust each other. And they're basically, even if they have the same naming convention, they're two different accounts to two different environments. And it even gets more complicated when you start thinking about FedRAMP as well. Imagine adding FedRAMP requirements to your IDP. It becomes even more complicated.
Yeah, we used to do that, exactly what you're talking about. We had a different IDP before they were called IDPs, right, for production. And at a minimum, it meant that the Unix admins were authenticating against a different infrastructure than the users. That's kind of what it was born of. And then over time, we separated it out. I don't know that when you can admin GitHub and GitHub's a crappy example, actually, but yeah, let's say GitHub, Figma, GCP, AWS, all that, when you can federate that with your IDP, and now all of a sudden somebody requests access to that, they're approved, and now you tick a box, and now their existing login has that ability, it's really tough to overlay another IDP on top of that, I think, in the modern world. Right, because what is it going to be? You're going to have, like, Okta over here and Ping over there, and usually you love one of those and hate the other one. But now you're like, well, the one you hate is going to be for prod because you don't use it as much. Oh shit, I love prod. Okay, sorry, we're going to switch it around. The one you hate is going to be for users. You're going to use something you usually want to pick the best of breed. So how do you multi IDP without getting worst of breed into the mix?
I wouldn't say multi IDP. I would say the same vendor. I like standardization.
Oh, multi instances of the same IDP.
Yes.
When you do that with Google SCIDP, and you're in a world of hurt. Yeah. Right. That's really confusing.
Get rid of passwords. Make it all your TPM chip on your phone, your laptop. Yeah. So get rid of passwords. You can also authenticate your laptop or your device as a trusted device before they can go to your GitHubs of the world. Use multi-factor authentication, FIDO2 with biometrics. Who's going to complain about that? Who complains about that? Put your finger in face.
I would just drop it on the primary IDP. maybe you step up to the hard tokens when you hit something secret or something important.
Yeah. So this is a difficult best practice, but it is a best practice that Microsoft has talked about for a while around never joining your admin or your security functions to the constituent domain, right?
That's right.
Your constituent domain gets popped, and now your backend control functions get popped as well. So, it makes sense for us then principle, but really, really hard to do in practice and really expensive in practice.
Today. It was easy to do at AD, but it's hard today as well.
Not easy to do in AD either. Anyway, that said, I mean, I think I would argue it is easier now because we don't have the difficulty even in standing up AD. It can be abstracted away because all you got to do is just spin up a new Okta, subscription or something.
Yeah.
So I think the perspective here is that it depends on your risk tolerance at the end of the day. If you want to not join your administrative functions through your constituent domain, you should really join it to something else that is separate from that constituent domain.
Yeah. But you're going to pass people when they have step up auth, even if they're using a single IDP. If you're the auditor, are you good enough with that?
Depends on the crown jewels at stake,
or if you're stepping up, if it's programmatically done where you, instead of a human being, it looks like it's some sort of script running on your laptop, suspicious, and then you ask for a second way of authenticating the person.
Behavioral step up.
That's right.
And again, keep in mind the focus here is procedural. You know, what are the processes that drive us to do something slightly different than our normal course of action, and that whatever that difference, however significant or insignificant that may be, the more significant it is, the harder it is for an attacker to circumvent that without getting noticed. If it's a very trivial process, for example, typing sudo and then typing your command. Mm-hmm. It can be easily circumvented, okay? But it's still a one-step process that makes it that much, you still got to circumvent that process as an attacker.
Right. Well, thanks, guys. I'm glad we had a chance to go through that thing because I think there's a lot of, paradigm shifts that are going on in technology, and sometimes we just kind of got to step back and see if it's time to review your expectations around all these things. So I think that kind of discussion is super helpful, and I look forward to doing more of that. So thanks, guys. Great, as always, to get together. It's always a lot of fun. I look forward to figuring out what we're going to tee up to argue about the next time. I love the contentious bits, the adversarial bits. But thanks a lot, guys. And I hope you have a great week and look forward to speaking again soon.
Thanks.